is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Professor William Damon, Bill Damon, Stanford University, the Hoover Institution, but the author, Bill Damon. The book is A Round of Golf with My Father. Subtitle, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. Bill, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. And we begin with your father, Philip Arthur Damon, Jr. of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. A young man in 1944, a momentary pause in his early Army volunteer drafting experience. He came home from his bivouac before the big push, Operation Overlord, and the conquest of the Hitlerites. However, he met a woman named Helen, a young woman just as himself, and they married your father. You were born within the appropriate months and never met your father when you were a child. Where did he go, Bill? What do we need to know about him before we explore all of the mysteries? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and thank you. And my father went back to the front. He went back to Germany and never came back. So all I knew about my father when I was growing up was that he was missing in World War II. Nobody seemed to know exactly what happened to him, or at least they weren't telling me. And it wasn't until about age 20 that I found out that he actually stayed in Germany. He did not come back, but he was not really missing. He was missing from me and from my life.
Philip A. Damon, Jr. comes from a successful childhood in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He was a very good golfer. In addition to the fact his mom and dad were well-to-do, not wealthy, but well-to-do, and had placed him at the superb Andover private school. Superb. And he'd also gone on to Harvard College. You knew none of this as a small child growing up. His experience in the military is profound, your reporting here. What about the military was compelling to your father, you know now, that might have suggested why he stayed in Europe?
When he was in the military, and this is what I found out decades later when I finally found out enough about him to do some research and got interested in him. He was in radio intelligence, and at some point he was assigned to be a temporary guard at a detention center in Lichfield, England. He stayed after the war because he was ordered by General Eisenhower and Eisenhower's staff to testify at a trial about how the Lichfield Detention Center was being conducted. During that time, my father was in England, he was in London, and I found from my research that he was in a very dramatic situation. He was responding and answering to his country's call to be a witness at this trial. And he was also enjoying London. He was a very young man. He was only age 22 when I was born. And part of the story is that he was having a good time in London. So there were a lot of reasons, I think, that he stayed over there, partly because of his duty, but also partly because he was enjoying England and then Europe later.
You're a professor of developmental psychology, and so in this book I learn a great deal about your field, which has been evolving in the course of your academic career, from your graduation from Harvard until now at Stanford University. And in your field, because you have a great amount to say in this book about developmental psychology, do you recognize now in your studies what it is that made it impossible for your mother and your grandmother? Your grandfather left you in 1948 with multiple sclerosis. He passed away. But your grandmother and her friends, your aunt, to tell you all those facts that we've just laid out. Do you understand that now in terms of psychology?
I do. Part of it is a cohort. effect. That's part of developmental psychology. All of us are shaped by the age that we grow up in. And people in that era, the era of my parents and especially my grandparents, especially in New England also, that's partly a cultural issue, were not very open about their feelings. They kind of toughed it out in life. That was part of the steely tradition of the people living in the greatest generation, and also partly the Yankee New England tradition. And so they didn't talk a lot about what happened, and they didn't feel a need to share with their child all of the what I think they thought of was the unseemly part of life.
Attending to your mother, Helen Myers. Ellen marries your father in 1944. It's a wartime marriage. These things are commonplace at the time. There's lots of talk about them. And then afterwards, the war brides, for example, the young men who married English women. All of these stories can have happy endings, but generally they did not. They went in different directions. Your mother is one of those. She spends some years thinking your father's coming home. 4 years, to my understanding, from 44 when he left her to 48. She has a brother, Jerry. Jerry influences her to file for divorce. Is that correct?
Jerry was actually her cousin. And yes, when my father never came back, and you're absolutely right, for about 4 years, my mother expected my father's parents expected him to return. When it finally dawned on everybody that he was staying over there, and he had found at that point a whole career in Germany as part of the United States War Department and later the State Department. When they finally realized he wasn't coming back, first of all, his parents, who were staunch New England Yankees, basically disowned him. They were appalled that he would abandon his wife and especially his child. And my mother gave up on him. She, I think, had a bit of a breakdown at some point and was very upset. But within a couple of years, she got her cousin Jerry, who was a lawyer, to file papers. And they became divorced, and she went on. She was a devout Catholic, and she went on to have the marriage annulled by the Catholic Church as well.
Yes, and a successful career woman in a generation where this was rare. Because she had opportunity, challenged necessity now to make her own way with you in the world. And she's living in Brockton. She joins an advertising firm, a prominent advertising firm. This is Mad Men period, as Bill tells us, the Mad Men. And women were in the office but not regarded as equals, and so therefore the pay was poor. But that doesn't stop your mother from going on to becoming what we would say today was an entrepreneur. Making shoes.
Right. Fortunately, she was tough and resilient. And even during the days of her advertising career, which was the 1950s, she wasn't treated very well, but she stood up for herself and developed enough of her reputation that she could move on to other careers in the fashion industry. She later designed shoes for some companies and then eventually, over the years, actually started her own little company. But she was a very early career woman. This was long before the age of women's liberation or any of that. And she was one of the people that pioneered like her had a lot of talents. And after a lot of hard knocks and bumps, she came into her own with her own career that reflected her talents, and I feel very good about that. It took her decades to really get there, but she stayed with it.
We've given you the outline now to understand some of the terms of Bill growing up. When we come back, how Bill learned about his father not being missing in action, not being dead, and what he did or did not do about it. The book is A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor speaking with Professor Bill William Damon. He is also the author of A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. We've had the rough outline of Father Philip Damon and Mother Helen Damon, Helen Myers Damon, and now Bill Damon, born 1944. In 48, he lost his grandfather, his father's father. He did have a visit that he remembers with his grandmother, who was a Yankee and spoke crisply and candidly of her son, who had disappointed her. However, at this point, the young Bill Damon doesn't have the story laid out in the fashion we've had. So the revelations begin on and off sometime, my guess, Bill, your story, sometime when you found yourself no longer in Brockton, Massachusetts, facing Brockton High School and a future after that, but at the Andover Academy. When did the revelations, in your memory, Bill, when did the revelations begin that you were strangely following your father's footpaths, never having met him?
Well, number one, when I was young, and that goes all the way to my college years, I really knew nothing about my father and didn't even want to think about him very much. I had some sense that I needed to make it on my own, and I didn't want to go around feeling sorry for myself. So when anybody would ask me about where my father was, I would just repeat what my mother kept telling me, which was, quote, he was missing in World War II. It was like a mantra. And that's all I allowed myself to think about. I think partly because I really wanted to fend for myself, and I didn't want to sink into, oh dear, I don't have a father. How am I ever going to get by? Then when I was in college, my mother visited my dorm one day and muttered, and I described her. She was not a very open and articulate person about her feelings, but she finally muttered a revelation. She said, you know, your father is alive, and he's been sending me child support of $100 a month, and I'm not contributing to your college, which was true, and I think I should share that. I was very embarrassed for her because it was a revelation that she had hidden his whereabouts from me for my whole childhood. I refused the offer of the child support, and I thanked her for the offer, and we never discussed the matter again. She lived for another 42 years, and to my regret, I never confronted her with it. I never asked her why she never told me the truth. So I just moved on in my life. Then, decades later, my own daughter got curious about what happened to her grandfather, namely my father, who nobody ever talked about. She went online, discovered a whole bunch of stuff online, and that's what got me going. And finally, I was ready to deal with it. I was ready to listen to it. I was ready to find out about it. I was mature enough. I was in my 60s already. And so I did some research. And then is when I found out that he actually went to the same school I went to. Oh, my God. That was a revelation. I couldn't believe it. The whole time I was at Andover, some of the same teachers that taught me taught him. And I wondered, did they know that? How come nobody ever told me? But that revelation really did change my understanding of how I got to where I got in my education and later in my life.
And here's a puzzle for the amateur reader, Bill. You're at Andover. You have teachers that overlap with you and your father. One in particular whom you admire greatly, your English teacher, Hart Day Leavitt. You had the same surname. You looked exactly like your father. Exactly. Maybe a little taller, but exactly. You have your mother's eyes. Yes, I understand, but you look like your father. You have the same name. Andover and all of the private schools in New England at that time and maybe continuing today were very careful in bringing in the next generation, the next generation, the next generation. It would have been logical that you were the son of. It never came up with your teachers. It never came up with the dean in your mother's correspondence. In the fact that you were at Andover, I have to believe that she made that choice in some way in conversation with your grandparents. It never came up. They kept it from you. What do you think, Bill?
So I'll tell you one thing that's interesting. First of all, when I dug up the old Andover records of my father, on his file was killed in action in World War II. So they also were deceased. Andover itself never knew what happened to him. And I'm wondering if my mother actually said something to the school or the people in the school that gave them some restraint about talking to me about my father. I'll never know. All of those people have passed away by now. And of course, my mother is long dead. So that's a mystery to me. I will never know why Hart Day Leavitt never put his arm around my shoulder and said, I knew your dad when he was a student, because I found out in my father's file that Hart Day Leavitt had written a long counseling report about my father. So he certainly knew him well. Why didn't he ever speak to me about him? I don't know, John.
The quote that Bill points to, I wrote it down, Bill, because it seemed determinative that it would have made you an honored student, an honored orphan of the war. Only child of a widowed mother, father killed in World War II, spelled out, World War, Roman numeral II. There must have been others, Bill. Do you remember others, other young people at Andover who'd lost their fathers?
Oh, there were a couple. And, of course, we were the object of some sympathy. But as I said, nobody ever directly talked to me about him. Or, as I said, I did not even know. There was so much silence that I didn't even know he went to the place. That was the astonishing revelation I found out only late in my life.
Well, not only Andover, but we're about to go on to Harvard College. You were at Harvard College within 20 years of your father being there. Again, the tradition is father, son, grandson, great-grandson. It goes on and on and on. And here they're either assuming you don't want to talk about it or your mother said something. The mysteries here, Bill, at this point, your book turns into a mystery story. All the conversations that we don't have.
And, you know, that was one of the purposes of the book, because I've discovered that a lot of people have these mysteries, family mysteries, mysteries about their childhood, things that they don't remember well. Nobody's memory is very accurate when it comes to going back to childhood. And the book, I think, is an example of how someone can help clear up these mysteries, even late in life, and the benefits of doing that. It helps you deal with all kinds of regret, questions about what would have happened if this didn't happen, where I came from, what shaped me, what my parents were really like. So, yes, my story may have more mysteries or more dramatic ones than others, but everyone has some mysteries in their life or in their parents' lives, and some people equally dramatic. And I've tried to give an account of how you go about thinking about that, researching it.
Let's go in search of your other family, Bill, when we come back. The book is A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. William Damon of Harvard and Stanford of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batzer. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking to the author, Professor William Damon, Bill Damon of Stanford University. He's at the Hoover Institution. The new book, however, is the important teaching tool about how to think of your own life in reflection. You don't have to be a senior figure such as Bill and myself. We're lucky enough to get here. But it helps. It helps a deal because you can laugh about yourself. However, the book takes us into some major theory that's been developed these last decades that I did not know, Bill, and I thank you for teaching me this. Let's do some definitions here. What is a life review? I believe Robert Butler is the man who identified the needs for this. What does it mean? What does it do for one?
Right. And Robert Butler was a legendary psychiatrist. He died in 2007. He was the first director of the National Institute of Aging and a Pulitzer Prize winning author about aging. And he developed a method that I adopted, which is a way of going back into your past in an intentional manner. We all go back into our past all the time. We always tell stories about ourselves, life stories of all kinds, but we usually do it in a random kind of haphazard way. And that doesn't always work for dealing with regrets, answering questions about how did I really make a choice that defined my life, and even more importantly, thinking about what comes next. What were the high points of our lives that we want to build upon for the future? And what are the parts that we just need to think about as regrets and learn our lesson from them and not go back there again? And the past is very important in our life. I quote Faulkner, who said famously, "The past is not dead. It is not even past." And that's really true. The past is who we are. It's our present. And also dealing with the past in the right way helps us deal with the future, helps us create our future. And that's what a life review can do. It is a systematic way of examining your own past, your parents' lives, your ancestors' lives, and trying to understand what the choice points were. What were the times when you were influenced by somebody else? What were the times when you made your own choice? What happened when those choices turned out well? What can we benefit from when we decide that a choice didn't turn out well? And how can we learn from it? Or how can we even find the positive side of something that looked like it might have been a mistake? So a life review is a way to systematically go back and try to create a positive narrative about your life that will lead a hopeful, optimistic way future and purposeful way. I emphasize purpose a lot. And what are your purposes in life and what will your purposes be when you make the right choices, if the purpose is in your future?
It is 1951, occupied Germany, the depths of the Cold War, and now the Korean War. The young Philip Damon Jr., who has not gone home, is now in the midst of what you'd have to say, a great deal of fun. He's a light-hearted young man in occupied Germany, able to travel to Paris, to London, to Berlin. He can move back and forth. And he meets a couple, the Warners, who are also in service of the U.S. Information Service, the U.S. Information Agency. And he's introduced by Mrs. Warner to a ballerina. And thus begins Philip Damon's second life, second family. Who is the ballerina and what does he learn from her? And does it change him, Bill?
Oh, I think so. It's Geneviève L'Espagnol was her name. And she was the prime ballerina in a Jean Cocteau ballet. And he met her going backstage after the ballet. And fell in love with her, and that was his second wife. And he and her had daughters who are now my treasured half sisters. So that was one of the great benefits of my doing the life review and discovering all of this. And I think my father, she was a wonderful wife to my father. And I think that my father's life, I think, as I characterized it through the research, was a maturing from a time in his life early when he was very irresponsible. He was a very poor student. He never did his work. He shirked his responsibilities. Of course, when he abandoned my mother and me, that was an enormous act of irresponsibility that I had to do some work to forgive him for. And in his military career, he discovered, I think, how important it is to be responsible. And he even became, I think, committed and courageous and patriotic in a very positive way. And then in his second marriage, he became finally a dedicated and good family man. But this, as you said, when he was a young man, he was carefree. He had no filters, as Isa Warner described him. He was a lot of fun to be with. but he was not a paragon of responsibility. It took a while. It took some maturing for him to get there. And the military played a role, and his second wife played a role.
He did not, at any point in the remarks that you accumulate, from 45, 46, to 48, to 51, he did never pretended you didn't exist. He would tell his colleagues that he was married or had been married and had a son. So he knew you were there, but there was no communication to your knowledge. Now, with his second wife, Genevieve, they have three daughters, and they moved to Thailand and are immediately embraced by the king and queen. So they have an experience in Thailand that is extraordinary, and they're no way pressed for income. Your father earns a very good salary, U.S. Army salary, but certainly I have here at November 1949, he was given a raise to $5,370, which is a lot of dollars in Asia in 1954 when he arrives there. And he's in Asia for 10 years. He doesn't communicate with you. But years later, you get a letter, I think when you're in college, from one of his daughters. Is that correct? I can't remember the date when you received that first letter.
That was actually 20 years after college, when I was about 40, and I had already had my three children and a full family. And I got a letter from somebody who claimed she was my sister. She actually was. But I didn't want to have much to – I answered it politely with a postcard and then let it drop because it was – I wasn't ready to think about my father. And also I, at that time, thought he was just a scoundrel, a no-account scoundrel who had abandoned my mother. I was very protective to my mother. I figured he hurt her very badly, and I wasn't ready to forgive him. So I kind of shut that communication down. And as I said, it took me until I was in my 60s and my own daughter got interested in the story. It took me that long to get past it and to be ready to then learn enough about him, respecting him and finally forgiving him.
Yes, the letter you received from one of your half-sisters, she passes away, so we do not have more of her testimony, nor do we have more detail about what she learned about you from Philip. But you do have this one remark from Lawen and Somali, your other two half-sisters.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's an odd remark. They remember your father when they talk to him about you. The quote is, "We don't speak of William here."
Yes.
And again, memory fools, Bill. Memory fools. What do they say of that now? What do they say of your memory, of their memory of Philip saying this? And why would he have such a thing? Where does it come from?
Yeah. I think by that time, he was not willing to disrupt his own emotional state by feeling guilty about abandoning his first son. And I, in fact, remember the first time one of them told me about it. I remember the story being he slammed his hand down on the table and said, "We do not speak of William here." But later they said, no, there was no hand slamming. But I'm wondering about whose memory, theirs or mine, added or the dramatic flair to it. But it was clear that he didn't want to have anything to do with me. And I think that was my resentment when I discovered the story. The reason the book is called A Round of Golf with My Father is that my big grievance that I had when I first heard later in life what he was like and that he was a great golfer was, why didn't the guy ever come around even once to teach me how to play the game, which I love, but I'm not that good at. And so finally I had an imaginary round of golf with him late in my life, pretending he was next to me on his old golf course with an old scorecard of his that I dug up from an old golf bag that one of my new cousins sent me.
Bill, it's my experience in reading too many novels, perhaps, that our wives, our daughters, our mothers, our sisters, our aunts are the keepers of the institution of the family.
Yeah, that's been my experience, too.
All right, you're surrounded by them. Your father, you... You're surrounded by them as your father was. And the puzzle here is they must have had a coherent understanding of what was going on. Did you ever receive from your grandmother, whom you knew, who was harsh about your father, from Verna, was her younger sister, I believe, or Genevieve, or your half-sisters, did anyone come to you and say, here's why he didn't talk to you, or here's what we think happened.
Nobody ever came to me, and I think that was part of the conspiracy of silence. I imagine they were communicating with one another and decided not to trouble little Billy with this information that might be upsetting. I don't know. As I said, that generation is not big on open communications. You know, this was the kind of greatest generation, and they were good at toughing things out. However, when I finally went to them, by the time of my early to mid-60s, when I was at that point eager to find out about things, everyone was very welcoming and open and gracious about it, all the people still alive. And that's how I was able to tell my story. And the information in the book comes out of that. So my mother at that point was dead. My grandmother was dead. But Verna was alive, my father's younger sister. And Isa Warner, his great friend, was alive. And these are the people that told me. And Genevieve was alive, his second wife. And all of them spoke to me very openly and told me wonderful stories about him. And that's how I was able to bring him to life in my book.
The book is A Round of Golf with My Father. We will get to the round of golf in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. A new psychology of exploring your past to make peace with your present. Professor William Damon, Bill Damon of Hoover Institution and Stanford University. When we come back, Bill's other life, the intellectual life of an educator. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Damon, William Damon, the author of a new book, A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. One of the ways Bill made peace is a round of golf. And let's get to it, Bill, because I want to speak of your father figures, but first, your father was a good golfer, and at one time you arranged to play on the Pittsfield course, which is a private club.
That's right.
And I followed your game very carefully in the way you explicated, the front nine, the back nine, and you had a score from the 1930s, and you matched the score to my reading. In fact, you surpassed your father because you scored in the low 90s and he was at 100, but then you explained that he was goofing around in the front nine and then really got serious in the back nine. And I thought, is this a metaphor? I have to be careful. I have to be careful of golfers when they tell me they focused on the back nine.
That's great, John. You're a good literary critic. I never thought about that. That is kind of a metaphor for his life. that's marvelous. Goofing around in the front nine and getting serious and committed in the back nine. Well, to be literal about it, the scorecard and my wonderful new cousin found a set of my father's golf club hanging in a garage in Middleton, Rhode Island. And I always thought, what kind of a family keeps golf clubs for 70 years or something like that? That says something about my father's family. But he sent me the clubs. I dug out of the slim canvas bag his old scorecard. And it turned out he was playing with some friends on the front nine and then played alone in the back nine, kept his scores. And the remarkable thing about his scores was that on the back nine, he shot a 43 with four pars. And these are using, of course, old clubs with real wooden heads and stiff irons and pre-Titleist golf balls that weren't even well balanced, a couple of which were still in the bag. And so, yes, you're right. When I went to the club, my overall score was better than his, but I could not match his scorching back nine with the four pars. And I was just, it was not a competition. I was pleased to see how good he was. That was one of the first things I heard about him. That was the source of my initial resentment. And I was able to get past that by this imaginary game where I pretended that he was there playing with me. He was only age 12 at the time he played with that scorecard.
You, of course, are a golfer shrewd enough to have played on the Royal and Ancient at St. Andrews. I see the photograph. So you're not a lighthearted golfer either to make that journey. However, I want to get to your professional life. Just a moment. to name one of your father figures, Roger Brown, your advisor, your senior thesis advisor at Harvard College, I have to believe that he, more than anyone else, pointed you into the field where you've published many books, and you're now again giving us your learning about the development of the adolescent and the development of character and of understanding of integrity, of virtue. Who was Roger Brown? What do we need to know about him?
He was a great social psychologist. In fact, he wrote the greatest textbook on social psychology ever. He was a wonderful lecturer at Harvard, and I was lucky enough to have him be my senior thesis advisor. He was kind of a legendary figure in the field. And you're right, his whole way of thinking, his whole worldview, set me off in a way that I think I approached the field in a way that was innovative, and it enabled me to study very subjects like purpose, the development of purpose, which were a little out of bounds and not really part of the experimental psychology field when I got started. Purpose was more of a philosophy or theology concept. But I think because of Roger's influence, I had the confidence to do that. And now purpose is dead center. There are thousands of studies, and I think that was probably my greatest contribution. My earlier book, The Path to Purpose, was the first real psychology book about this.
You have two quotes in the book, and I won't give away which one I like better, because you can like them both. One from Steve Jobs in an address at Stanford University, a graduation address. You cannot connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards, so you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect you to your future. That's Steve Jobs, who left us too early. And this from Henry David Thoreau. If we will be quiet and ready enough, we shall find compensation in every disappointment. Which do you like, Bill? I know you like them both, but which helps you understand now your father?
Well, I think it was the Thoreau quote was deeper, although I don't want to give short shrift to Jobs. And I was on the platform in commencement when he made the speech. So I have a close memory of that. But the Thoreau point really gets to the main point of the book, which is really about redemption. It's about redeeming those parts of your life which you have a hard time getting past because they feel so full of resentment or regret or just wrong turn that you sort of say, gee, my life would have been better without this. But actually, if you think about things in the right way, just as Thoreau said, you can find the bright light or the learning lesson or even the sense that you would not be who you are now if that hadn't happened. And of course, you need to value who you are now. That's, to use a golf metaphor, you play it as it lays. That's all we have. We make the best of what we are and where life has brought us. And so it's that redemption of the past that leads the way to a future of integrity and hopefulness. And Thoreau was able to say in a sentence what maybe it took me a whole book to write with all the psychological theory and so on.
What I take from your book more than anything else, Bill, now reflecting upon the reading of it, is in reading this book, the reader goes through a checklist in my own experiences, my father, my grandfather, my mother, all of those things. That's what your book helped me do, Bill.
And I'm so glad, because that is what I was hoping, is that in my own quest, which had a certain amount of pain to it, I have to say, going back through these difficult memories. But in my own quest, I hope that I gave an example of how somebody can really do this, even when you're hesitant. I avoided doing this for 60 years of my life. I batted away all the clues that came up, every single invitation I had. And I finally got around to doing it, and I'm so glad I did.
The title, A Round of Golf with My Father, William Damon, the author, Bill Damon of Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.